understood why it would continue to soar. She told Peter, "I don't care what you're saying. This stock is what got me here." Over the next 4 months, Peter's team kept trying to convince her to begin the diversification process, but the client wouldn't listen. During that time, the stock dropped by half, costing her $5 million. She was so upset that she dug in her heels even more and insisted on waiting for the stock to recover. It never did. If she had listened to this well-considered advice that contradicted her own beliefs, she would now likely be on track toward a life of total financial freedom. In fact, this is also an example of another emotional bias called the endowment effect, in which investors place greater value on something they already own, regardless of its objective value. This makes it much harder to part ways and buy something superior. The truth is, it's never wise to fall in love with an investment. As the saying goes, love is blind. Don't get swept off your financial feet. The solution: ask better questions and find qualified people who disagree with you. The best investors know they're vulnerable to confirmation bias and accordingly do everything they can to counter this tendency. The key is to actively seek out qualified opinions that differ from your own. Of course, you don't want just anyone with a different opinion, but rather someone who has the skill, track record, and intelligence to give another educated perspective. All opinions are not created equal. Nobody understands this better than Warren Buffett. He consults regularly with his 93-year-old partner, Charlie Munger, a brilliant thinker who is also famously outspoken. In his 2014 annual report, Buffett recalled that Munger had single-handedly convinced him to change his investment strategy, persuading him that there was a smarter approach. "Forget what you know about buying fair businesses at wonderful prices. Instead, buy wonderful businesses at fair prices." In other words, Warren Buffett, the greatest investor in history, has openly attributed his success to his willingness to follow the advice of his partner, whose logic was irrefutable. That's how powerful it can be to resist our tendency to seek opinions that merely confirm our own. Ray Dalio, too, is obsessed with the idea of searching for divergent viewpoints. "It's so difficult to be right in the markets," he told me. "So what I've found very effective is to find people who disagree with me and then find out what their reasoning is. The power of thoughtful disagreement is a great thing." As Ray explains, the key question is, what don't I know? You can benefit greatly as an investor by finding people you respect. Ideally, this includes a financial advisor with an extraordinary long-term record, and asking them questions designed to uncover what you don't know. Whenever I'm contemplating a major investment, I speak with friends who think differently, including my wise pal and genius entrepreneur, Peter Guber. I explain what I believe, and then I ask, where could I be wrong? What am I not seeing? What's the downside? What am I failing to anticipate? And who else should I speak with to deepen my knowledge? Questions like these help to protect me from the danger of confirmation bias. Mistake 2. Mistaking recent events for ongoing trends. Why most investors buy the wrong thing at exactly the wrong moment. One of the most common and dangerous investing mistakes is the belief that the current trend will continue. And when investors' expectations aren't met, they often overreact, leading to a dramatic reversal of the trend that previously seemed inevitable and unstoppable. A perfect example of this phenomenon occurred election night in 2016. Hillary Clinton, by far the frontrunner, was expected to win by a landslide, or at least by a significant margin, according to nearly every poll. At noon on election day, bookies around the country gave her a 61% chance of victory. But by 8 o'clock, the situation flip-flopped completely, giving Trump a 90% chance of winning. As the election results became clear, investors panicked because their expectations about the future were suddenly turned upside down. The market responded violently, with Dow futures dropping more than 900 points. Ironically, the next day, the market snapped back in the opposite direction, with the Dow jumping 316 points, as investors began to adjust to their new version of reality. We witnessed a Trump rally that continued for weeks. As I write this in December 2016, the S&P 500 just hit an all-time high For the third day in a row, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has scored its 11th all-time high in a month, and the market has surged 6% in 7 weeks since the election. How do you think investors feel right now? Pretty cheerful, that's how. When you read that the market is roaring ahead, it's hard not to feel a little rush of delight. Maybe you peek at your investment portfolio and notice that it's the highest it's ever been. Life is sweet. Granted, I have no idea where the market is headed from here, and as the greatest investors in the world will tell you, neither does anyone else. But I do know that people get carried away at times like this. In the stacking of emotions and beliefs, they start to convince themselves that the good times will keep on rolling. Likewise, when the market is plunging, they start to believe that it will never recover. As Warren Buffett says, investors project out into the future what they have most recently been seeing. That is their unshakable habit. What's the explanation for this? There's actually a technical term for this psychological habit. It's called recency bias. This is just a posh way of saying that recent experiences carry more weight in our minds when we're evaluating the odds of something happening in the future. In the midst of a bull market, the neurons in your brain help you to remember that your recent experiences were positive, and this creates an expectation that the positive trend is likely to continue. Why is this so problematic? Because as you know, the financial seasons can suddenly change, with bull markets giving way to bear markets and vice versa. You don't want to be that guy who, after a long, sun-drenched summer, concludes that it'll never rain again. Great things are not accomplished by those who yield to trends and fads and popular opinion. Jack Kerouac. I recently interviewed Harry Markowitz, a famous economist who won the Nobel Prize for developing modern portfolio theory, the basis for much of what we know today about how to use asset allocation to reduce risk. Harry is a financial genius, and at the age of 89, he's seen everything under the sun, so I was eager to speak with him about the most common investing mistakes we need to avoid. Here's what he told me. The biggest mistake that the small investor makes is to buy when the market is going up on the assumption that the market will go up further, and sell when the market is going down on the assumption that it's going to go down further. In fact, this is part of a much broader pattern of believing that current investment trends are bound to continue. Investors repeatedly fall into the trap of buying what's hot, whether it's high-flying stock like Tesla Motors or the latest five-star mutual fund, and abandoning what's not. As Harry puts it, whatever is going up, that's what they buy. People assume that these shooting stars will continue to burn brightly, but as we warned in Chapter 3, today's winners tend to be tomorrow's losers. As you may recall, one study looked at 248 stock funds that received Morningstar's 5-star rating. 10 years later, only 4 of them kept that rank. Even so, brokers routinely promote funds that outperformed in the previous year, only to see these recommendations underperform the following year. Investors tend to arrive just as the party is winding down. They miss out on all of the gains and participate fully in all of the losses. David Swensen summed this up neatly, telling me, "Individuals tend to buy funds that have good performance, and they chase returns. And then, when funds perform poorly, they sell. And so they end up buying high and selling low, and that's a bad way to make money." The solution: don't sell out, rebalance. What the best investors in the world do is create a list of simple rules to guide them so that when things get emotional, they stay the course and remain on target long term. You might want to start making a list of your own, an investment success checklist for the flight deck, that spells out where you're trying to go as an investor, what you have to watch out for, and how you plan to navigate the journey securely. Share your flight plan with someone you trust, ideally a sophisticated financial advisor. He or she can help you stick with the program by making sure you don't violate your own rules with impulsive survival brain decisions. Think of this as the financial equivalent of having a co-pilot to clarify and verify that you're not heading into the side of a mountain. An important component of these investment rules is deciding in advance how you're going to diversify by allocating a specific percentage of your portfolio to stocks, bonds, and alternative investments. What will your ratio be? If you don't lock it down, circumstances will change and your mood will change with them. You're likely to react to the moment instead of sticking consistently with an asset allocation that's ideal for you over time. If you recall, one of the solutions to this emotional stumbling block is to regularly rebalance your portfolio once a year. What does that mean? Harry Markowitz gave me a clear example of an investor who starts with 60% of her portfolio in stocks and 40% in bonds. If the stock market soars, she might find herself with 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds. So she would automatically sell stocks and buy bonds, thereby restoring her portfolio to her original asset allocation ratio. The beauty of rebalancing, says Harry, is that it effectively forces you to buy low and sell high. Mistake 3. Overconfidence. Get real. Overestimating our abilities and our knowledge is a recipe for disaster. Forgive me for getting personal here, but let me ask you 3 questions. Are you an above-average driver? Are you an above-average lover? And are you better looking than the average person? Don't worry, you can keep your answers to yourself. My reason for asking you these impertinent questions is to raise a fundamental point that could be vitally important to your financial future. Humans have a perilous tendency to believe that they're better or smarter than they really are. Again, there's a technical term for this psychological bias. It's called overconfidence. To put it simply, we consistently overestimate our abilities, our knowledge, and our future prospects. Countless studies have described some of the wonderfully absurd effects of overconfidence. For example, one study found that 93% of student drivers believe they are above average. In another study, 94% of college professors consider themselves above average in the classroom. There was even a finding that 79% of students believed their character was better than most, despite the fact that 60% admitted they had cheated on an exam in the previous year. We each envision ourselves as a member of the "I'd never do that" moral minority. All this reminds me of Lake Wobegon, the fictitious Minnesota town invented by the writer Garrison Keillor, where all of the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. So how do individual investors become overconfident? In many cases, a professional convinces them that there is a hot new investment that's going to crush everything out there, and they allow that person's passion to become their unwarranted confidence. In other words, one person's salesmanship fuels another person's misguided certainty. Some individuals are extremely successful in running a business or living their lives, so they just assume that they'll be equally as effective as an investor. But investing, as you know now, is more complex and challenging than it might initially seem to these high achievers. Are certain people more prone to overconfidence? Finance professors Brad Barber and Terence Odeen examined the stock investments of more than 35,000 households over 5 years. They found that men are especially prone to overconfidence when it comes to investing. In fact, men traded 45% more than women, reducing their net returns by 2.65% a year. When you add to this the additional costs of high transaction fees and taxes, you can see that excessive trading is truly a disaster. But there's another form of overconfidence that can prove even more costly. The perilous belief that you, or any TV pundit, market strategist, or blog writer, can predict what the future holds for the stock market, bonds, gold, oil, or any other asset class. If you can't predict the future, the most important thing is to admit it, Howard Marks told me. If it's true that you can't make forecasts and yet you try anyway, then that's really suicide. The solution: get real, get honest. One of the best antidotes to overconfidence is to stand in front of a mirror and ask yourself this: do I really have an edge that will allow me to be a market-beating investor? Unless you have some secret sauce, for example, the superior information and analytical skills that distinguish great investors such as Howard Marks, Warren Buffett, and Ray Dalio, there's no rational reason on earth to believe you can outperform the market indexes over the long run. So, what should you do? Easy. Do what Howard, Warren, Jack Bogle, David Swensen, and other of the world's greatest investors tell the average investor to do. Invest in a portfolio of low-cost index funds and then hold them through thick and thin. This will give you the market's return without the triple burden that active investors must carry: exorbitant management fees, high transaction costs, and hefty tax bills. If you can't add value, if you can't create an asymmetry, then the best thing you can do is minimize your costs, says Howard. In other words, just invest in an index. Index funds also give you broad diversification, which is another powerful protection against overconfidence. After all, diversification is an admission that you don't know which particular asset class, which stock or bond, or which country will do best. So you own a bit of everything. Here's the great paradox. By admitting to yourself that you have no special advantage, you give yourself an enormous advantage. How come? Because you'll do so much better than all those overconfident investors who delude themselves into believing they can outperform. When it comes to investing, self-deception may be the biggest expense of all. Mistake 4. Greed, gambling, and the quest for home runs. It's tempting to swing for the fences, but victory goes to the steady survivors. When I was 19, I rented a house in an upscale community by the Pacific Ocean in Marina Del Rey, California. One day I was dropping off some clothes at a local dry cleaner when a convertible Rolls-Royce Corniche pulled up and a gorgeous woman stepped out. I couldn't help but pay attention. We started chatting while she picked up her clothes, and I asked what she and her family did for a living. She told me that her husband was in penny stocks and had done really well. "I can see that," I said. "Do you have any tips?" She replied, "Actually, right now, there's an extraordinary one." She gave me the name of a hot stock, and let me tell you, it felt like a gift from on high. A sure thing right from the horse's mouth. So I took $3,000, which was the equivalent of $3 million for me back then, and I bet it all on that one stock. And guess what happened? It went to zero. Boy, did I feel like an idiot. As I learned from that painful experience, greed and impatience are dangerous traits when it comes to investing. We all have a tendency to want the biggest and best results as fast as possible, rather than focusing on small incremental changes that compound over time. The best way to win the game of investing is to achieve sustainable long-term returns, but it's enormously tempting to swing for home runs, especially when you think other people are getting rich faster than you. The trouble is, you're more liable to strike out when you swing for the fences, and that can be devastating. As we discussed in Chapter 6, all of the best investors are obsessed with the idea of not losing. Remember our math lesson? When you lose 50% on an investment, you need a 100% return just to get back to where you started, and that could easily take you a decade. Unfortunately, the desire to gamble is built into us. The gaming industry knows this well and ingeniously exploits our physiology and psychology. When we're winning, our bodies release chemicals called endorphins, so we feel euphoric and don't want to stop. When we're losing, we don't want to stop either, since we crave those endorphins and also want to avoid the emotional pain of losses. Casinos know how to manipulate us by pumping in extra oxygen to keep us alert and by plying us with free drinks to reduce our inhibitions. After all, the more we play, the more they'll win. Wall Street isn't all that different. Brokerage houses love it when customers trade a lot, generating a blizzard of fees. They try to lure you in and hook you with advertisements that offer free or low-cost trades, along with market insights that will supposedly help you pick the winners. Yeah, right. Do you think it's a coincidence that your online trading platform looks and sounds like a casino, with green and red colors, scrolling tickers, flashing images, and dinging sounds? It's all designed to unleash your inner speculator. The financial media reinforces the sense that the markets are just one giant casino, an intoxicating get-rich-quick scheme for speculators. It's easy to get sucked in, which is why so many people lose their shirts by betting on the hottest stocks, trading options, and moving in and out of the market. All this activity is motivated by the gambler's desire to hit the jackpot. What you need to understand is that there's a world of difference between short-term speculation and long-term investing. Speculators are doomed to fail, while disciplined investors, who stay in the market through thick and thin, set themselves up for victory thanks to the power of compounding over time. Wall Street wins by getting you to be more active, but you win by patiently staying in the game for decades. Remember, as Warren Buffett says, the stock market is a device for transferring money from the impatient to the patient. The solution. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So here's the big question. In practical terms, how can you silence your inner speculator and force yourself to be a patient long-term investor? One person who's obsessed with this question is Guy Speer, a renowned value investor. Guy began coming to my events 2 decades ago, and he credits me with inspiring him to model the best investors. He applied this idea by modeling Warren Buffett's long-term approach to investing. In 2008, Guy and another hedge fund manager even paid $650,100 to charity to have lunch with Buffett. As Guy sees it, one of the biggest barriers to success for most investors is that they get distracted by all the short-term noise on Wall Street. This makes it much harder for them to hold their investments for the long run and harness the awesome power of compounding. For example, they frequently check the performance of their investments, and they listen to TV pundits and market experts making useless predictions. When you check your stock prices or fund prices on your computer every day, you're feeding candy to your brain, says Guy. You get an endorphin hit. You have to realize it's addictive behavior and just stop doing it. Move away from the candy. Guy suggests checking your portfolio only once a year. He recommends avoiding financial TV entirely, and he suggests that you disregard all research produced by Wall Street firms, recognizing that their motive is to push products, not to share wisdom. The vast majority of what purports to be analysis and information about the stock market is actually just designed to generate activity, to get us to pull the trigger because somebody out there will make money out of the fact that we're being active, he explains. If it's activity generating information, we should shut it off. Instead, Guy recommends creating a more wholesome information diet by studying the wisdom of ultra-patient investors such as Warren Buffett and Jack Bogle. The result? You're feeding your mind thoughts that will make it much easier for you to think and act long-term. Mistake 5. Staying home. It's a big world out there, so how come most investors stay so close to home? Humans have a natural tendency to stay within their comfort zone. If you live in the United States, you're more likely to crave a cheeseburger with fries than a feast consisting of foie gras, poutine, or escargot. Likewise, you probably have a favorite grocery store, gas station, or coffee shop that you visit regularly instead of venturing further afield. When it comes to investing, people also tend to stick with whatever they know best, preferring to trust what's most familiar. This is known as home bias. It's a psychological bias that leads people to invest disproportionately in their own country's markets, and sometimes to invest too heavily in their employer's stock and their own industry. For our cave-dwelling ancestors, home bias was a savvy survival strategy. If you ventured too far outside the hood, who knew what dangers might be lying in wait? But in our own era, investing globally actually reduces your overall risk. That's because different markets are imperfectly correlated, which means they don't move in lockstep. You don't want to be overexposed to any country, even if it's where you live, because you never know when it will hit a rough patch. In the late 1980s, Japanese investors had 98% of their portfolios in domestic stocks. This paid off handsomely for most of the 80s, when Japan seemed to be on top of the world. Then in 1989, the Japanese market collapsed, and it's never fully recovered. So much for home sweet home. A report by Morningstar showed that the average American investor in mutual funds had almost three-quarters, 73% of his or her total equity allocation invested in the U.S. stock market at the end of 2013. Yet U.S. stocks accounted for only half, 49%, of the global equity market. In other words, Americans significantly overweighted the U.S. market, leaving them relatively underexposed to foreign markets such as the United Kingdom, Germany, China, and India. In fact, it's not just American investors who view the rest of the world with suspicion. Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, who are leading experts on behavioral finance, have written that Swedish investors have an average of 48% of their money in Swedish stocks, despite the fact that Sweden accounts for around 1% of the global economy. A rational investor in the United States or Japan would invest about 1% of his assets in Swedish stocks. Can it make sense for Swedish investors to invest 48 times more? No. The solution: expand your horizons. This is really simple. As we've said in previous chapters, you need to diversify broadly, not only in different asset classes, but also in different countries. It makes sense to discuss your global asset allocation with a financial advisor. Once you've decided on the appropriate percentages to keep at home and abroad, you should write down these figures in your investment success checklist. It's also important to lay out in writing the reasons why you own what you own. That way, you can remind yourself of these reasons whenever a part of your portfolio is underperforming. The best advisors help you to keep a long-term perspective so you can avoid falling into the common trap of favoring whatever market is in vogue. Harry Markowitz, who has a deep sense of history, told me, "We've recently had a long stretch where the U.S. market has been doing better than the European market, and emerging markets have had a dry spell. But these things come and go." By diversifying internationally, you're not only reducing your overall risk, but also increasing your returns. Remember when we talked about the lost decade of 2000 through 2009, when the S&P 500 produced an annualized return of only 1.4% a year, including dividends? During that time, international stocks averaged 3.9% a year, while emerging market stocks returned 16.2% a year. So for investors who diversified globally, those lost years were just a minor bump in the road. Mistake 6. Negativity and loss aversion. Your brain wants you to be fearful in times of turmoil. Don't listen to it. Human beings have a natural tendency to recall negative experiences more vividly than they do positive ones. This is known as negativity bias. Back when we were cavemen, this mental bias was really handy. It helped us to remember that fire hurts, that certain berries could poison us, and that it was dumb to pick a fight with a hunter twice your size. Recalling negative experiences can also be pretty helpful in modern times. Maybe you forgot that it was your wedding anniversary, spent the next day in the doghouse, and thereby learned never to make that mistake again. But how does negativity bias affect the way we invest? Thanks for asking. As you know, market corrections and bear markets are regular occurrences. Remember, on average, corrections have occurred about once a year since 1900, and bear markets have occurred about once every 3 to 5 years. If you lived through the bear market of 2008-2009, you know firsthand how emotionally painful these experiences can be. If, like many investors, you owned funds or stocks that plunged by a third or a half or more, you're not likely to forget those negative experiences anytime soon. Now, you and I both know that the best investors relish corrections and bear markets because that's when everything goes on sale. By now, I'm sure you remember Warren Buffett wants to be greedy when others are fearful, and Sir John Templeton made his fortune, do you remember? That's right, at the point of maximum pessimism. At this point, I'm guessing that your rational mind knows that market crashes are a wonderful opportunity to build long-term wealth, not something to fear. But negativity bias makes it hard for the average investor to act on this knowledge. Why? Because in the midst of market turmoil, our brains are wired to bombard us with memories of those negative experiences. In fact, there's a part of the brain, the amygdala, that acts as a biological alarm system, flooding the body with fear signals when we're losing money. Even a minor market correction is liable to trigger our negative memories, causing many investors to overreact because they're afraid that the correction could turn into a crash. During a bear market, this fear reflex goes into overdrive, making investors anxious that the market will never recover. To make matters worse, the psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky also demonstrated that financial losses cause people twice as much pain as the pleasure they receive from financial gains. The term used to describe this mental phenomenon is loss aversion. The trouble is, losing money causes investors so much pain that they tend to act irrationally just to avoid this possibility. For example, when the market is plunging, many people sell their battered investments and go to cash at exactly the wrong moment, instead of snapping up bargains at once-in-a-lifetime prices. One reason why the best investors are so successful is that they override this natural tendency to be fearful during periods of market turmoil. Take Howard Marks. In the last 15 weeks of 2008, when financial markets were imploding, he told me that his team at Oak Tree Capital Management invested about $500 million a week in distressed debt. That's right. They invested $500 million a week for 15 straight weeks during a time when many thought the end times had arrived. It was obvious that everybody was suicidal, Howard told me. In general, that's a good time to buy. By focusing calmly on this bargain-hunting opportunity, Howard and his teammates made billions of dollars in profits when winter ended and spring began. This would never have been possible if they had succumbed to fear. The solution. Preparation is key. By failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. Benjamin Franklin. First of all, it's important to be self-aware. Once we know that we're vulnerable to negativity bias and loss aversion, we can counter these psychological tendencies. After all, you can't change something if you're not aware of it. But what specific measures can you take so that fear won't knock you off course even in the most tumultuous times? As we discussed in Chapter 7, Peter Malouk had tremendous success in helping his clients navigate the global financial crisis. One reason? He educated them in advance about the risks of a bear market, so it wasn't as surprising or scary when it actually occurred. For example, he explained how each asset class had performed in previous bear markets, so they were prepared mentally for what could happen. They also knew in advance that Peter planned to use this turmoil to their advantage, selling conservative investments such as bonds and deploying the proceeds to buy more stocks at bargain prices. We provided certainty about the process, says Peter, so they knew exactly what to expect. This dramatically reduced their uncertainty. In other words, the single best way to handle market turmoil and the fears it can trigger is to be prepared for it. As we've discussed at length, one critical way to prepare is to have the right asset allocation. It also helps to write down your reasons for investing in each of the assets in your portfolio, since inevitably there will be times a particular asset class or investment performs poorly, sometimes for several years. Many investors lose faith because they're so focused on the short term. But when the going gets tough, you'll be able to look over these notes and remind yourself why you own each asset and how it serves your long-term goals. This simple process can take a lot of the heat and emotion out of investing. As long as your needs haven't changed and your assets are still aligned with your goals, you can sit tight and give your investments the time they need to prove their value. It also helps immeasurably to have a financial advisor who can talk you through your fears and concerns during the most difficult times, reminding you that the strategy you agreed upon in writing when you were calm and unemotional is still valid. It's a bit like flying a plane through a really rough storm. Most pilots would be just fine if they were flying solo, but it's a whole lot easier when you know that you've got an experienced co-pilot in the seat beside you. Remember, even Warren Buffett has a partner. Mastering your mind. Now that you're aware of these destructive psychological patterns, you're much better positioned to guard against them. Given that we're human beings, we're bound to trip up from time to time. After all, the biases we've discussed in this chapter are part of our ancient survival software, so we can't expect to eliminate them totally. But as Guy Speer says, this isn't about getting a perfect score. Even small improvements in our behavior can deliver enormous rewards. Why? Because investing is a game of inches. If your returns improve by, say, 2 or 3 percentage points a year, the cumulative impact over decades is astounding, thanks to the power of compounding. The systematic solutions we've discussed in this chapter will go a very long way, helping you to avoid or minimize the most expensive mistakes that the majority of investors make. For example, these simple rules and procedures will make it easier for you to invest for the long term, to trade less, to lower your investment fees and transaction costs, to be more open to views that differ from your own, to reduce risk by diversifying globally, and to control the fears that could otherwise derail you during bear markets. Will you be perfect? No. But will you do better? You bet. And the difference this makes over a lifetime can amount to many millions of dollars. Now you understand both the mechanics and the psychology of investing. You know what it takes to master your mind so that you can invest successfully over the long term. The knowledge you've acquired is priceless, and it can enable you and your family to achieve total financial freedom. So let's get to our final chapter and learn how to create real and lasting wealth.
Chapter 9, Real Wealth. Making the most important decision of your life. Every day, think as you wake up, today I'm fortunate to be alive. I have a precious human life. I'm not going to waste it. The Dalai Lama. If this book helps you to become financially free, I'll be thrilled for you. But if I'm honest, I don't believe that's enough. Why not? Because having financial wealth doesn't guarantee you'll be wealthy as a human being. Anybody can make money. As you've learned in the previous chapters, the tools and principles you need are pretty simple. For example, if you harness the power of compounding, stay in the market for the long term, diversify intelligently, and keep your expenses and taxes as low as possible, your odds of attaining financial freedom are extremely high. But what if you achieve financial freedom and you're still not happy? Many people dream for decades of becoming millionaires or billionaires. Then when they finally reach their goal, they say, "Is this all there is?" And believe me, if you get what you want and you're still miserable, then you're really screwed. When people dream of becoming rich, they're not fantasizing about owning millions of pieces of paper with pictures of deceased notables on them. What we really want are the emotions we associate for money. For example, the sense of freedom or security or comfort that we believe money will give us, or the joy that comes from sharing our wealth. In other words, it's the feelings we're after, not the money itself. I'm not belittling the importance of money. If you use it well, there are countless ways in which it can enrich your life and the lives of those you love. But real wealth is about so much more than money. Real wealth is emotional, psychological, it's spiritual. If you're financially free, but you're still suffering emotionally, then what kind of victory is that? Maybe this strikes you as an odd digression in a book about money and investing, but I'd feel remiss if I wrote an entire book that shows you how to achieve financial wealth while neglecting to share with you the secret how to achieve emotional wealth. Fortunately, you don't have to choose between them. As you'll discover in this chapter, it's possibly financially rich and emotionally rich. This, my friend, is the ultimate prize. To my mind, the chapter you're about to hear is undoubtedly the most important in this audiobook. Why? Because what you're about to hear is that there is a single decision you can make today that can truly change the quality of the rest of your life. This one decision, if you consistently act on it, will bring you more joy, more peace of mind, more real wealth than most people can imagine. And best of all, you don't need to wait 10, 20, or 30 years. If you make this one decision today, you can be rich right now. The truth is, I want to share this idea with you because it's changed my life so powerfully. So if you're ready to join me, let's begin the final step in our journey. An extraordinary quality of life. My entire life has been focused on helping people turn their dreams into reality. I've visited more than 100 countries and have spoken with people from every corner of the earth about what they really want. And you know what I found? Every culture has different beliefs and values, yet there are fundamental needs and desires that all human beings share. What I found is wherever I go, we all crave an extraordinary quality of life. Now, for some people, that means owning a beautiful home with an exquisite garden. For others, it means raising three wonderful children. For some, it might mean writing a novel or a song. For others, it means building a billion-dollar business. And for others, it just means being closer with God. In other words, it's not about living somebody else's dream. It's about living a magnificent life, which is really life on your terms. But how can you achieve this? How can you close the gap between where you are today and where you really want to be? The answer, you need to master two entirely different skills. The science of achievement. The first is what I call the science of achievement. In every field, there are rules of success that you can either break, in which case you'll be punished, or follow through on, in which case you'll be rewarded. For example, there's a science to health and fitness. Biochemically, we're all different, but there are fundamental rules that you can follow. And if you do, you're going to thrive. You're going to have high levels of energy. If you violate those rules, you're going to pay the consequences. It's the same in the financial world. Just think about what you've learned in this audiobook. The most successful investors left a trail of clues for us to follow. By studying these patterns and applying these tools, strategies, and principles in your own life, you'll accelerate your journey to success. It's obvious, right? Sow the same seeds of the most successful people and you'll reap the same rewards. That's how you'll achieve financial mastery. When it comes to the science of achievement, there are three key steps that can enable you to achieve whatever it is you want. Can you think of something fantastic that you've achieved in your life that once seemed impossible? Maybe it was a relationship, or maybe it was a dream job, or a successful business, or owning, you know, some special sports car. Think about how this dream went from being impossible to actually being in your life. What you'll find is that there's a path to achievement that is followed, and it fundamentally has three steps. The first step to achieving anything you want, think about it, when you really wanted something badly enough, you began to focus on it. Focus is power. Remember, wherever your focus goes, your energy flows. When you put your entire focus on something that really matters to you, when you can't stop thinking about it every day, this intense focus unleashes a burning desire that can help you obtain what might otherwise be out of reach. Here's what's going on beneath the surface. A part of your brain called the reticular activating system, also known as the RAS, is activated by your desire, and this mechanism draws your attention to whatever can help you achieve your goal. The second step is to go beyond hunger and drive and desire and consistently take massive action. A lot of people dream big but never get started. To succeed, you need to take massive action. It is the cure-all. But you also need to find the most effective execution strategy, which means you got to keep changing your approach till you find what really works. Now, you can speed this process up exponentially by modeling people who have already been successful, which is why we focus so intensely on the money masters like Warren Buffett and Ray Dalio and Jack Bogle and David Swensen. By studying these incredibly successful role models, you could learn in a week what might otherwise take you a decade. The third step to achieving whatever you want is what I call grace. Some people call it luck, some people call it God. Here's what I can tell you. Based on my life experience, and I think you find this true in your own, the more you acknowledge grace in your life, the more you seem to have more of it. I've been amazed to see how a deep sense of appreciation brings more and more grace into our lives. Of course, you need to do everything in your power to achieve your goals, but there are still things over which you have no control. Even the fact that you're born at this time in history, you're given a brain and a heart you didn't have to earn, that you get to benefit from the awesome power of modern technologies like the internet, none of which was within your control, nor did you create these gifts. Now, you know these three basic keys to achievement. If you look at something once was impossible and now is in your life, I'm sure you got obsessively focused on it. I'm sure you took massive action and grace has flown to you because it's in your life today. But as important as achievement is, there's a second skill that you'll need to master if you truly want to create an extraordinary life. This is the skill I call the art of fulfillment. The art of fulfillment. For decades, I was focused obsessively on the science of achievement, on learning to master the external world, and on figuring out ways to help break through and solve every challenge I could. But I gotta tell you, I really believe now in my heart and soul that the art of fulfillment is an even more important skill to master. Why? Because if you master the external world without mastering the internal world, how can you truly sustain happiness? That's why my greatest obsession today is truly the art of fulfillment. The $86.9 million painting. As I mentioned earlier, we each have a different idea of what constitutes an extraordinary quality of life for us as individuals. You know, put this another way, what fulfills you is likely to be different than what fulfills me or anyone else. Our needs and our desires are infinitely and marvelously diverse. One experience that brought this home to me was an unforgettable day that I spent with my dear friend Steve Wynn. A few years ago, Steve phoned me on his birthday to see where I was. As luck would have it, we were both staying in our vacation homes in Sun Valley, Idaho, so Steve invited me over to hang out. He told me on the phone, "Tony, when you get here, I've got to show you this painting. I've coveted it for more than a decade, and I outbid everyone at Sotheby's 2 days ago, and I finally bought it. It cost me $86.9 million. Can you imagine how intrigued I was to behold this precious treasure that my friend had dreamed of for so long? I was imagining some sort of Renaissance masterpiece as I was driving over, something you might see in a museum in Paris or London. But when I got to Steve's house, you know what I found? A painting of a big orange square. I couldn't believe it. I took one look at it and jokingly said, "Give me $100 worth of paint, and I can duplicate this in an hour." Steve wasn't overly amused. Apparently, this is one of the greatest paintings by the abstract artist Mark Rothko. So why am I telling you this story? Because it perfectly illustrates the fact that we're all fulfilled by different things. Steve is so much more sophisticated than I am when it comes to art, so he can detect a depth of beauty, emotion, and meaning in those brushstrokes that I couldn't see. To put it another way, one man's orange splotch is another man's $86.9 million fantasy. Now, while it's true that we're all different, there are still common patterns when it comes to achieving fulfillment. If that's your goal, what principles or patterns of behavior do you think you can model? Well, the first principle that makes us fulfilled is that we must keep growing. Everything in life either grows or dies. That goes for relationships, businesses, or anything else. If you don't keep growing, you'll become frustrated and miserable no matter how many millions you have in the bank. In fact, I can tell you, the secret to happiness is one word, progress. Progress equals happiness. Even if you're not there, but you're making progress to things that matter, you're going to start to feel more fulfilled. The second principle is you have to give to feel fully alive. If you don't give, there's only so much you can feel inside. You'll never feel absolutely alive. As Winston Churchill said, quote, "You make a living by what you get. You make a life by what you give." Whenever I ask people about the most fulfilling aspects of their lives, something that really has touched them, I ask them, what's the first thing you want to do? And they almost always say, I want to share with somebody I love. That's because the true nature of a human being isn't to be selfish. We're driven by our desire to contribute at a deep level. We want to share. It makes our life richer to share. If we stop feeling that sense of contribution, we'll never feel truly fulfilled. It's also worth reminding ourselves of the obvious truth that becoming financially rich is not the key to fulfillment. As you and I both know, people often chase after money in a delusional belief that it's a kind of magic potion that's going to bring joy, meaning, and value to their lives. But money alone will never give you an extraordinary life. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time with billionaires, and some of them are miserable. I wouldn't say you'd feel sorry for them, but almost. And if you're not happy, you can't have a magnificent life, no matter how fat your wallet may be. Remember, money doesn't change people. It just magnifies who they really are. If you have a lot of money and you're mean, you have a lot more to be mean with. If you have a lot of money and you're generous, you'll naturally give more. What about professional success? Well, it's wonderful if your success brings you a sense of growth and contribution. We all need that to feel fulfilled. But I'm sure you've met plenty of successful people who never seem to be happy or fulfilled. And how does that qualify as success? In fact, I truly believe in my heart and soul that success without fulfillment is the ultimate failure. Let's think for a moment about a painful example of this. A national treasure. In 2014, we lost someone who I consider to be a national treasure, the actor and comedian Robin Williams. Over the last couple of years, I've spoken to audiences all over the world about this astonishingly gifted man. And again, I ask the same question. How many of you in this room loved Robin Williams? And I'll tell people, don't raise your hand if you liked him, only if you loved him. And you know what? Every place I go, from London to Lima, from Tokyo to Toronto, about 98% of the people in the audience raised their hands. Now, here's a question. Was Robin Williams a master of the science of achievement? Absolutely. He started out with nothing, but then he decides he wants to star in his own TV show, and he does it. How many people say they're going to go to Hollywood and become a star and actually achieve it? He doesn't stop there. Then he decides he wants to have a beautiful family, and he creates it. Then he decides he wants more money than he can spend in a lifetime, and he makes that happen. Then he decides he wants to become a movie star, not just TV, and he does it. Then he decides he wants to win an Oscar for not being funny, his number one skill, and he does that too. Here's a man who has it all, who achieved everything he'd ever dreamed of achieving. And then he hanged himself. Think about that. He hanged himself in his own home, leaving behind hundreds of millions of people who love him to this day, and even more devastating, leaving behind his wife and children traumatized and brokenhearted. When I think about this terrible tragedy, I'm struck by one simple lesson. If you're not fulfilled, you have nothing. Robin Williams achieved so much that our culture has conditioned us to value, including fame and fortune. Yet despite all his gifts, it was never enough. He suffered for decades trying to deal with his stress through the use and sometimes the abuse of alcohol and drugs. Near the end of his life, he was also diagnosed with a progressive neurological disorder, Lewy body disease. His wife Susan wrote in the medical journal Neurology, quote, "Robin was losing his mind and he was aware of it. Can you imagine the pain he felt as he experienced himself disintegrating?" Look, Robin Williams was a good man who cared deeply about others, a man who contributed so much joy to the world, despite his long battle with addiction, depression, and ill health. But in the end, he made everybody happy, except himself. This reminds me of the importance of the safety instructions that they announce whenever you get on an airplane. Quote, "In the event of an emergency, please put on your oxygen mask before assisting others," end quote. It sounds callous and selfish when you first hear it. I'm going to put the mask on myself and not my child? What are you, nuts? But it actually makes sense. Unless you help yourself first, how can you help others? You'll be in trouble. You won't be able to help the people you care about. Believe me, I know that Robin Williams is an extreme example. I'm not worried you're going to go kill yourself. But I see so many people, even the richest, even the most successful people, who are missing out on so much of the joy and fulfillment they deserve to experience. And I want you to experience that joy and fulfillment today, not someday in the future. Yet nobody teaches us really how to be happy. To suffer or not to suffer, that is the question. A man is but the product of his thoughts. What he thinks, he becomes. Gandhi. Let me tell you the story of what changed my own life. Over the last 2 years, I've been on a marvelous journey of the mind, and maybe even more importantly, of the heart. I'm always looking to grow personally, so I'm constantly exploring different tools, strategies, and ideas to help reach a new level. A couple of years ago, I went to India, and I was visiting a dear friend of mine named Krishnaji, who was equally fascinated by these questions about how to achieve an extraordinary quality of life. And as my friend knows, I've taught for many years about the power of being in an energy-rich state, a peak state, if you will, where you can accomplish anything, where your relationships are filled with passion, where there's energy pulsing through you. By contrast, some people allow themselves to live in more of an energy-poor state, where the body feels lazy, the mind feels sluggish, and you can't really do anything much but worry, get frustrated, and snap at people. My friend said to me one day, "What if you use different words to describe those two states?" As he explained, there are really only two states you can live in any given moment of your life. Either you're in a high-energy state that could be described as what he called a beautiful state, or you could be in that low-energy state, and often characterized by internal pain that could be described often as a suffering state. He told me that his spiritual vision was really simple. He's committed to living every day in a beautiful state no matter what happened in his life. That was the gift he wanted to give those around him and himself. Krishnaji then echoed what I and so many others have taught for years. We can't control all the events in our lives, but we can control what those events mean to us, and thus what we feel and experience every day of our lives. By consciously choosing and committing to live in a beautiful state, my friend believed that he could not only enjoy so much more of his life, but he could also have so much more to give his wife, his child, and the world at large. I thought a lot about what he'd said, and now look, I'm an achiever. If you're listening to this audiobook, you probably are too. And we achievers, we don't believe that we ever suffer, do we? No, we just have stress. In fact, if you told me 2 years ago that I was suffering, I would have laughed at you. I have a heavenly wife, 4 glorious children, total financial freedom, a mission that inspires me every day of my life. But then I started to take the time to really look deeper, and I allowed myself to see that, yes, there are times why I fall into a suffering state. For example, I get frustrated or pissed off or overwhelmed or, you know, worried or stressed about stuff. And at first I think, well, those emotions are just part of life. They're no big deal. In fact, the truth is I even convinced myself that I needed them as fuel to move me forward. But this was just my mind playing tricks on me. See, the trouble is the human brain isn't designed to make us happy and fulfilled. It's designed to make us survive. This 2-million-year-old organ is always looking for what's wrong, for what can hurt us, so that we can either fight it or flight from it. And if you and I leave this ancient survival software running the show, what do you think the chances of really enjoying your life are? An undirected mind operates naturally in survival mode, constantly identifying and magnifying these potential threats to our well-being. The result? A life filled with stress and anxiety, no matter how much money you have. And yet, most people live this way, since it's really the path of least resistance. They make unconscious decisions based on habit and conditioning, and they're at the mercy of their own minds. They assume that it's just an inevitable part of life to get frustrated and stressed and sad and angry. In other words, to live in a suffering state they think is natural, just like I used to. But I'm happy to tell you there's a whole nother path available, one that involves directing your thoughts so that your mind does your bidding, not the other way around. This is the path I chose. It's the one I really want to entice you into in this chapter. I decided directly that I was no longer going to live in a suffering state. I decided what I was going to do is everything in my power to live in a beautiful state for the rest of my life, every single day, and become an example of what's humanly possible. Not something fake and phony, something real, something that has the joy that we all deserve to have. And after all, think about it. There's nothing worse, is there, than a rich and privileged man or woman who's angry and ungrateful? Flying high and falling low. Now, before we go any further, let's just clarify the difference between these two emotional and mental states. Let's talk first about a beautiful state. When you feel love or joy, gratitude, awe, playfulness, ease, creativity, drive, caring, growth, curiosity, appreciation, or anything like that, you're in a beautiful state. And you know what it feels like. In this state, you know exactly what to do, and you do the right thing. In this state, your spirit and your heart is alive, and the best of you comes out. Nothing feels like a problem. Everything has flow, and if there is a challenge, you just solve it quickly. You don't feel a bunch of fear or frustration because you're in harmony with your true essence. By contrast, a suffering state is when you're feeling stressed out, worried, frustrated, angry, depressed, irritable, overwhelmed, resentful, or fearful. Any of those states or ones like it are suffering states. We've all experienced these and countless other negative emotions, even if we're not always keen to admit it. But as I mentioned earlier, most achievers prefer to think they're stressed than fearful. But stress is just the achiever word for fear. If I follow the trail of your stress, it'll take me to your deepest fear. So what determines whether you're in a beautiful state or a suffering state? You might assume that it depends mostly on your external circumstances. If you're relaxing on a beach eating ice cream, of course it's easy to be in a beautiful state. But in reality, the mental and emotional state in which you live is ultimately the result of where you choose to focus your thoughts. In fact, the state you're in is the result of the last thought you've had. Let me give you an example from my own life. For the last 25 years, I've flown around the world doing seminars, and specifically, I've flown between America and Australia usually 3 times a year. Nowadays, I'm privileged to have my own plane, which is a little bit like having a high-speed office in the sky. For better or worse, there's no need to ever disconnect from work, and I'm so grateful for the privilege. But I can vividly remember the dread I used to experience whenever I'd get on a commercial flight to Australia, and I'd wonder how I could possibly live without my connection to emails and texts for the next 14 hours. How could my business possibly survive without me? Then one magical day, I was on a Qantas Airlines flight to Sydney, Australia, when the captain proudly announced that the plane had international internet access for the first time. All around me, people started cheering and clapping and high-fiving one another. It was as if God had descended from on high and entered the plane. I didn't stand up and do a jig, but I have to confess in my mind I was clapping too. But then, after 15 minutes of giddy delight, do you know what happened? You guessed it. We lost internet access. It didn't work for the rest of the flight, and it's probably still not working after all these years. So how do you think passengers reacted to the change? We were crushed. 1 minute we're euphoric, the next minute we're cursing our terrible misfortune. What's amazing to me is how quickly our perspective changed. Moments earlier, internet access had been a miracle. Now it was an expectation that wasn't being met. All we could think about was that the airline had violated our inalienable right to internet access, a right that hadn't existed until that very day. In our outrage, we'd instantly lost sight of the wonder that we're flying through the air like a bird, crossing the globe in a matter of hours and watching movies or sleeping as we flew. Birds can't do that. Isn't it ridiculous how jaded we are and how upset we allow ourselves to become over little things? I mean, when it rains on our parade, when we don't get what we want or expect, we're so quick to give up our happiness and sink to a state of suffering.